It's Monday, December 15th, 2014, and you're listening to episode 359 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 50 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
This is Wayne.
My name's Chad.
My name is Pat.
All right, so we're going to start this out with something that kind of gives me a heavy heart, which is, if you recall, an episode or two ago, I talked about receiving The Hunter's Hunted from a listener to the show, a guy by the name of Thunderbelly. His real name is Tobias. And unfortunately, we lost one of our own. A couple days after he sent me this book, I was talking with him on Facebook, and he mentioned that he was having some kind of pneumonia sort of episode, and he became very ill and unfortunately passed away. And I mean, obviously it's upsetting in general because he's one of our own, all that stuff, but also he was, you know, not all that old. So this was not something that was expected. But anyway, you know, just Tobias, wherever you're at, God bless and Godspeed. So let's talk about something more upbeat now.
Yeah.
Like Ebola.
Like Shel Silverstein.
Yes.
Let's just put his picture on top of Hunter's Hunted.
Yeah.
He will be the watchman that does vigil over this book.
Okay, something more upbeat.
I'm not going to mess with that book.
You know, like on Halloween, they used to wear like masks to scare demons. I think it actually wasn't demons. It was
evil spirits.
Yes, angry spirits. Yes, yeah. You tell me, you walk around with Shel Silverstein strapped on your face, every ghost would be like, out,
not,
done.
Not a Shel Silverstein mask. With Shel Silverstein himself strapped to your face.
Or you just go like Buffalo Bill style and have like a Shel Silverstein suit.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, you want to talk about something more upbeat, like heart disease?
Actually, we do need to talk about that, though the pun there on beat was pretty terrible. But we are still doing the Christmas charity for the American Heart Association that we're doing in competition with a couple other podcasters and such.
We're winning right now, by the way.
I will link to that again in the show notes. If you've not had a chance to make a donation, you have some extra cash this holiday season, please do contemplate passing out that way. It's a good charity. You can go onto all the various charity watchdog sites and check their stats, and they always get positive reviews. And they are working on the condition that is the leading cause of death amongst people in pretty much the entire world, certainly within the Western world. So please do strongly contemplate about giving to them.
Absolutely.
Moving
on. Now, can we get to something upbeat?
Yes. All right. So
that isn't Shel Silverstein?
Yeah, we were talking about
so
this.
So always spay and neuter your pets.
Yes. Yeah. He's dead too.
So at dinner, we were talking about a game that I'm getting in on, which is an online game with John, George, Little Sexy from the Trap Cast, Miranda, and a guy whose name I forgot. I think Mario or something like that. I just made that up. I think it is actually Mario. I don't know.
It's a me, a Mario.
Right. But anyway, I'm getting in on this, and they're doing the Blood Moon Goblins thing, and they're not doing the same plot line, but it's set in there, and John is not the one running it. Miranda is running his setting. Well, John, being John, of course, decided that he's going to method one it. Right? So he talks everybody else in the group to method wanting it, and all of them come out with what you would expect, these gimpy-ass characters. Now, for anyone who doesn't know what method one is, in the older D&D books, there were multiple ways you could create a character. And method one was the least forgiving of them. You took 3 6-sided dice, rolled those once for each of your attributes straight down the page. So your first 3d6 is strength, your next 3d6 is con, and you just go straight down like that. And whatever you roll is what you play.
Didn't you also roll for class as well?
Not exactly. I'm getting to that. Now, it was funny because I made my character last night, and I was the last person to make my character. And, you know, John was putting pressure and good fun on me to do method one. So I'm like, fine, I will. And I rolled it like a boss. It was like 11, 12, 15, 18, 12, 9 or something like that. I rolled this boss-ass character and clowned his method one system. All right. What we were talking about dinner, though, was Chad was kind of making fun of how some people...
Well, it's not a method to generate a character. It's a badge of machismo competition that I just do not understand.
It's like the cinnamon challenge or something. They're walking on hot coals. It's just like something people do just to prove they can do it.
Oh man, I roll a real character. I roll method one. And it's just like, I just make a character.
Yeah.
That's all. I guess you're more of a man. Congratulations.
There is another mindset though behind method one characters. And this is something that I would actually like to run a game using, but I have a somewhat different approach to it, a different take on what its role is. In the original D&D setup, you rolled method one, and then Wayne, to your point, you did not roll class, but what you were creating was a person. Your character starts off just as a person, and you method one, and this is what your person is. You didn't design it. This is what you were given to play, except you were given it by your own rolling, okay? So effectively, randomly. And then the next thing you do is you look at the book, and based on the attribute requirements, you see what you can be.
So no one gets to be a paladin.
Essentially,
that was the idea. That's paladin right, that was version, supposed to be a rare class, right. and that kind of enforced it.
I forgot about that. That version had requirements for classes, yes. Didn't it?
And so the idea was that you would create a character. Think of this kind of like real life. Your attributes are what you're born with, right? Okay, so this is kind of your innate abilities. And then what you're seeing is based on that, when you go out into the world and you meet with this or that guild or these people or whatever, what is it you actually are capable of even doing or falling into? And I would love to run a game that way because of the fact that it does a sort of rollback on the amount of control you have over who your character is at the outset. You can't necessarily play to a rut unless you get lucky because of the fact that the character is out of your control. You know, what you're capable of, you can't say, well, I'm going to play a cleric. It's more like, well, actually, you may not be a cleric. That may be what your character wants to be, and that's great role-playing, but you're just not cut out for it. I mean, I'd wager many people listening to this right now, probably myself included, would love to do things for a living. We just plain aren't capable of doing or didn't have the opportunity to do.
If I could only be a porn star.
But what? Oh, yeah, of course. You but are. What a horrible way to try to introduce somebody to the fucking hobby that we have. To say, oh, okay, let's role play. Really? You know, what is it? Well, you can play whatever you want. Not really. You roll these things and say, well, I want to be a paladin. You can. Sorry. Asshole,
you could be.
You can only be a fighter.
You can be.
You can
whatever,
be fighter.
Yeah, you can be whatever you want as long as majority yeah, most of the time.
You start going
on this.
Well, I want to be a paladin. Sorry, you don't qualify. Oh, okay. Well, I'd like to be a bard. No, not going to be that. Okay. Well, maybe I'll be a cleric. Sorry. Like at that point, I just get up and fucking leave.
Well,
I mean,
done,
it's that, and that's why I don't like method one. I'm out there. I don't like it. I think it's fucking horrible because that would be like you, Dan, pulling up one of your JRPGs or one of the games that we play on a sure. console, whatever, and it's like all of a sudden you say, well, I like to play a human. Nope, sorry, you don't qualify to be a human.
Humans are in the game.
They are, but you don't
but
qualify.
Only one,
your randomly generated stats right. do not allow you.
One in
you
50,000 copies of your game allows you.
You have
to be
a Martian, and then the Martians are going to kill the humans.
Let me give you a couple.
And it has you have to be this. You have to be a class that you can't stand to play. I'm like, what the fuck?
Well, let me give you a couple counterpoints. I mean, first of all, what
it's
you're
saying. It's machismo bullshit. That's right. Chad's right. It's yes. Well, either way.
Oh, machismo. Is it? Really?
I've heard both.
Fair enough.
I'm,
fair
you know.
Enough.
I've gone through several people in several words because of the fact that romance languages share words but different pronunciations.
Yeah,
are the L's pronounced or does it become like a Y type sound?
It for varies. Me, it was always machismo. Uh-huh. Like ma cheese. Mo.
I hear you. That's what it was for me because that's what Razor Ramon, that's how he pronounced it.
Gotcha.
Now, what's yours?
Machismo.
Machismo.
Yeah, not
like
cheese. Not a ch, but a key.
Yeah,
like a
keys
K.
instead of cheese.
Machismo. Yeah. Machismo.
Right.
Machismo.
But
whatever.
What I was going to say is, first of all, it does not JRPG style define the character for you. All it's setting is class parameters. It's taking,
that's what I mean.
It's taking 8 to 10 classes. You still have complete control of the character. Except what the character does for
right.
Him.
Yeah, you can't.
Which is a far cry.
You can still
cry.
Be your own pitiful f***ing little loser guy that can't
well,
be what you really want to be.
That's a far cry, though, from a
but
JRPG.
Not because, well, but, I know. I was,
where
just,
the
I was just using that as
defined.
An example. I was just trying to put an example for you. Not JRPG. Like, it's f***ing Skyrim. Whatever you want to call it. Whatever video game you're going to have. You want to go in it and play. Like in Mass Effect 3. It would be like telling me, I cannot play the sniper class.
Well, I'll make a
which
different
is
example.
I want to play.
You play Force Unleashed, you can't be a stormtrooper.
Okay.
You're handed a character. I mean, this is not some wildly
well,
out
again,
of our...
Right. Again, just examples. Right. But I'm saying, like in a game, in a role-playing game, you should have the ability to play whichever class you want.
All right.
Well, method one only...
Because it is fantasy, and you're doing this for escapism. It's
method,
not
only has life. That problem.
If I
want to
be bound by the fact that I can't be what I want to be, I'll just be real life. I'm gonna roll. Shut the f- up, Wayne.
No, because Method One only has that problem if you're playing an older version of D&D that has requirements
that's
for the
what
class.
We're talking about that. We're talking about that now. We were talking.
Yeah, but I play Pathfinder.
That's where Method One comes in.
I do Method One on Pathfinder.
First defined though.
I do Method One on Pathfinder occasionally against John.
Chickens at one point
because I enjoy the challenge to myself. If I want to play outside of my comfort zone, I'll roll up Method 1 when John does, because I only deal with Johns in the game, mm-hmm. too. And I'll build a character around that, and I take it as a challenge of how did this character get those particular stats? You know, what am I going to do class-wise?
I've taken it a step back farther than that. I've only done this twice in my gaming career. But both times, it went incredibly well. Both of these campaigns were very successful campaigns. And what I did is I started with people. These were both D&D campaigns. They started at level 0. They were classless. And I think they later changed that. They created something like a commoner class. But at the time, you were a zero-level classless character. Mm. And so the idea, I told them, all I want to know is who you are. That's all I want to know. And by who you are, I don't mean what you do for a living. I want to know about you as a person. What kind of family are you being raised in? What are your loves? What are your hates? What are your fears? What are your hopes? All that kind of thing.
I'm a fighter who fights.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm trying to get away from. You know, is there a patron deity you have?
You know, there's a lot of systems that you could do that
and
do get away from that. D&D is...
Well, it can, though, is the point.
Yeah, but you kind of got to.
But then within the course of the game, if they wanted to be something in particular, and of course, this was typically the first or second plot arc within the game, was seek those places out and put yourself into some kind of training with them. It would be shortened to just descriptors mm-hmm. or something. I mean, I wouldn't torture us out where they would just spend forever. And they might have little errands or little tasks or tests that they would have to complete.
But you need a training montage.
The only thing
a song.
That, well, and there were tests that people had to complete. Like, and I'd slip it into the role play. Like one of them was for a priest. There was someone in the game that ended up dying, and the test was to see what they did. Did they actually take the time to bury the body and do the rites and all that kind of stuff? And all of them had some kind of like little shakeout test like that. That was not right in their face. Like, hey, here's the gauntlet or something. I mean, it wasn't that sort of thing. But it went really well. Now, the only thing I didn't
do
with that...
You must go through the 36 chambers of Shaolin.
Yeah, but the only thing I didn't do there was I did not take it back a step and say do Method 1 as well, where once again, you wanting to be something is not necessarily mean you're going to be. Now, you can still be the person you want to be. You just may not be in the job you want to be
So, I don't have a problem with Method 1 because I really don't care about making a character in that way. I don't like rolling dice to make a character. Because I don't like the idea of a dice and randomness making my character. I mean, I see the fun of it to come to the table and say, I don't know what I'm going to get, and I'm going to make something from that. Just my preference is I prefer to make all the different aspects of my character instead of the random dice making.
I like the point by aspect.
That's more of a preference.
Well, and I get it. It depends on the game for me. Sometimes I go in knowing what I want to play.
Sure.
And if I know what I want to play, I don't want to roll for it. I want to build
make it.
Yeah. If I don't have an idea necessarily, then I want to do random.
And it can provide some inspiration. What I don't like about Method 1 is not the method, but the machismo. The sort of John really gets behind this, but I've met a lot of other people who are like, oh man, Method 1, that's a real man's way of rolling. Yeah, we're going to do it because you don't know what you're going to get. It's living life on the edge. It's like you're playing D&D. You're a fucking nerd, dude. Come on. We're all nerds here. I don't think we need to get on this jock trip crap of rolling to see how big our e-peen is.
Right.
And I just don't care.
Let me stress something, which
maybe
is that
I'm just too old and tired for that.
Mm-hmm. I am not saying this is the way to game by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, I would say
there's nothing wrong with the method at all.
And I would say in 90 some odd percent of the games that I play, I am right with Pat in that picking what I play is part of the enjoyment of role playing. But I think there is sometimes fun in being pushed a little outside your boundaries by having to work with what you're given.
Oh, sure.
I mean, we do this all the time at con games where you might be handed a character and you have to interpret that and work with that. And I realize people say, well, that's just a one shot, which is true. But I think you can have fun with this over a long game if character exploration is your thing.
Yeah. I look at Traveler. I was in one of Church's Traveler character creation sessions. And then the next year I played Traveler with him. And the character that was created was one I would have never thought of. It was the random life events that we rolled for that created that character. And I ended up loving it because it was something, it was not just outside the comfort zone. It was just something I would have never thought of. It was something different and unique.
And that's cool. You know, I played lots of great games with that. The vast majority of the aspects of the character, at least on the paper, are completely random. And that randomness allows you to interpret aspects of your character out of it. Is he a big guy? Is he a strong guy? Is he kind of dumb? Is he? And then what you do with that is you start asking the hard questions of why. Why is he dumb? Was he just born that way, or was he hit with a brick on the head as a kid? Or, you know, is he just not educated? Does he not realize his full potential? You know, dozens and dozens of methods and ways and you can interpret the data that you have generated.
I'd say I look at occasional dice roll like that, just like the leading questions.
Mm-hmm.
They get me thinking about that character. I don't want to do that for every game. If I already know my character, I don't need it.
Yeah.
All right, for our topic today, this one comes from Chad. So
hi, I'm Chad.
Yeah.
I've got a topic.
Hey, everybody, welcome Chad, if you've never heard of him before.
Hi. Hey, everybody. So, yeah, this topic that I have comes from this game we played on Sunday, and it was actually an interaction that we had with Wayne's wife, Sarah. We're playing Monster Hearts. We had our first game of Monster Hearts, and she is playing what's the character class called?
Kalaka.
Kalaka. Yeah,
colostomy.
More or less. She's basically a skeleton, a mummy.
She's the living embodiment of death wearing a skin suit.
Right, right. And she's doing this sort of Egyptian flair on it. It's like how you play a mummy without actually being and, you know, wrapped in toilet paper. She's essentially a skeleton, living embodiment of death. And she has killed someone, I think. I didn't really get into that. Pulled their skin off and wears them like a Buffalo Bill skin suit. Anyway, my character is interacting with her, and part of the powers that she has in Monster Hearts is that she can pull pieces of herself off of herself, like her hand. She can pull the bones of her hands out, and it makes a bony sort of thing from Adam's Family that can run around. It's really creepy. She is by far the most disgusting character we have. I mean, it's like a ghost and a witch and a demon and then that. But it's really cool. Because we're all trying to be, like, moody and scary, and then she's like, pop, pulls her hands off. We're like, ah! But anyway, she pulled off very subtly. She was in this dance with all these people. She wanted to keep an eye on the dance or something, and then she left. And so what she did is she pulled a bone out of her foot and left it on the ground, like sort of in the corner. And then she left, and that way she can kind of sense what was going on or something in the dance or whatever. Well, my character is a ghost, and I am a 100-year-old former medical student, because we're all college students and stuff. We were playing in 1959, and I died in 1859. But I was a medical student, and so I'm at this dance, and I see this, you know, it's like, oh, there's a metatarsal right there or something like that, or whatever the hell a toe bone is called. And, you know, I pick it up and suddenly it's like, you know, Sarah, your character's, somebody's messing with your bone. Comes back. We have a role play about it. You know, I'm like taller than her. I'm like keeping it away and like, I'm not giving this back. And she zoop and uses this power because it's her and it's like spiritually connected to her. And it kind of wings out of my hand. And we don't quite know, since it's the first game, what we are. Like, only Pat knows I'm a ghost and, you know, that sort of thing. And nobody knows that Sarah is this thing, right? So I kind of did the first to find out, because this bone whips out of my hand and it's part of her toe. And so it shoots down onto her foot and zoop, right back in. So I'm playing it like, okay, the thing whizzed out of my hand, blew a hole through her shoe, and her toe went and it's back. And I was like, oh, whoa, mama. And that is not right. And so we do a little bit of role play about that. Then later on, there's a scene later where I'm role playing with Pat's character, because Pat's character is a witch and she knows that I am a ghost. And so, hey, Pat's character, whose name I forgot, you have to keep an eye out for that one, Sarah's character. And, why is that? Well, let me tell you why that is. And there's this role play, and it's a good role play. It's not just exposition. There's this back and forth and role play, and then sort of our mood and opinion kind of shifts about her, sort of, ooh, scary, what's going on there? Then Sarah says, and I don't blame her for saying this, because what she says is really cool. She's like, you know, in thinking about it, That's not what happened. What happened was the bone flew out of your hand into my hand, and then I pulled the lid of my eye out, dropped the bone in there in front of you, and you saw the bone move through the skin of my body down my foot, and we're like, ah! But it changed the conversation, right? Yeah. It retconned the scene to where I didn't just say all of what I had just said. So I guess the question here is, what do you do? What I did was I just hand waved. I literally waved my hand and I just looked at Pat and said, I didn't say any of that. Let's just keep rolling. And it was fine.
And I find usually this happens for the same reason it started here.
Yeah.
Was the two players had a different vision of what happened in the scene.
And hers was much cooler than mine was.
Yeah, because she always thought that it just went back to her hand and she put it on. You always thought it went through her shoe.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until the whole conversation started that we realized that. I find when this happens to me a lot is when I'm GMing versus being a player. And I treat it differently when I'm a GM versus a player. When I'm a GM, well, the world just changed. And if that seemed odd, why is that odd? Yeah, that's now a mystery.
And let me add some perspective on that as an outsider. The scenario that you just gave excellently illustrates a point. In that particular scenario, it almost to me would have been a non-issue. It's like, well, I mean, really, all we did here was just up the gratuity. It's not like, it illustrates a point, right? Which is that you can have something occur in role play that should not have occurred because you used a power you didn't have. You used knowledge you didn't have.
Which there, also happened.
There was an error in description. Like, I describe something to you. A, B, and C happen. And then we do all this role play. And then 45 minutes later, I'm like, oh, my God. It wasn't A, B, and C. I flaked. It's X, Y, Z. Yeah. Or and it's just like, crap.
And I'm with Wayne. As a GM, this can really put you on the burner if you describe setting wrong or an NPC is supposed to be telling the party something and they botch it. Yeah. And they confuse the parties or they tell it the reverse of how it occurred. And I've had this happen many times. And so, as you describe, you're left what may be an hour, a couple hours, maybe a couple game sittings later. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, hell, that's not right. And that's not just some little nuance to solve. We have a real issue here. This should not have happened at all.
Yeah.
And possibly even a bunch of subsequent decisions or role-playing moments should not have happened.
As a GM, I always take it as what I said at the table is the way it is in the world, which means I do a lot of retconning of what I had planned. As a player, I don't think I do that so much, though. As a player, I try to straighten it out and figure out what we should do going forward.
Beth,
as a GM, I just put it all on myself, though.
Beth and I had this exact problem. She was running a one-shot game, but it was supposed to get pretty deep, serious game. It wasn't like goofy, silly. Because if it's a goofy, silly game, everybody's in high spirits anyway. It's very easy to hand wave, right? But when you're trying to be really serious and get deep, it's much harder. I had this character who was an assassin, but he wasn't necessarily a bad person. He was being held to it. There was this supernatural like demon force or whatever that had possessed his daughter and was like, okay, you are going to infiltrate this palace and you're going to kill this guy. I'm like, I don't want to. I'm not a murderer. I don't do bad things like this. And the possessor was basically like, if you don't do this, takes out a knife and the daughter just starts stabbing herself because it's possessing her. And it's like, okay, don't hurt my daughter. I'll do this. You must release her, though. Typical kind of story, right? Well, I had emailed all this to Beth, and then it had been like 2 weeks later. Well, she got some of the points confused in the story. Like, for instance, she thought my daughter was my wife. So we played and played and played, and then the big reveal comes out. This sultry woman trying to seduce me, but it wasn't her. Wow. And it was like this big twist. And I'm like, Beth? wait a minute. Why is she doing this? Because she didn't say your wife. She just says the person.
My daughter Courtney Stoddard?
and she's like, she was confused because she's like, what is the problem?
Looks across the table. You see, on Beth's face, she doesn't quite understand why Chad's not jumping at
like,
this.
Like, horrified.
On Chad's face, I see him trying to figure out what's going on here.
Yeah. We're trying to roleplay this out because it isn't spoken. She does not say, your wife comes out and tries to seduce you.
It's just narrating the situation.
Yeah. And I, being a good player, I'm trying to roll with it really uncomfortably.
After all, you know, maybe there's an angle here.
Yeah.
Maybe she's still possessed and the spirit's really trying to mess with me now, trying to wreck your brain.
Yeah. But it got kind of obvious to a point, and one or both of us were like, whoa, time out. And we're whipping out our phones and we're like, okay, let's look at this email here. And it's like, she's my sister, or she's my daughter. What? Oh my God. She's pulling out her phone and she's like, she had to rewind 20 minutes of role play and change part of her plot based on that entire thing. So just on that one change of information. And again, if it were silly, it wouldn't have mattered so much. In fact, we could have even played that off as the joke, but...
Well, let's take this in the context of a larger game.
Yeah.
I'm going to rewrite that situation just a little bit here.
Sure.
Let's say it was a long ongoing campaign.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that was running 2 years in length.
Yeah.
And you guys are 6 months in, and this is a huge part of your backstory. Mm-hmm. The daughter doesn't come to you.
Mm-hmm.
Because the daughter's trying to do whatever, the spirit's trying to do whatever, the daughter first goes to Pat's character. And Beth and Pat have a sidebar that you're not even aware of.
Ah, yeah.
And, oh, his wife and blah, blah, blah. And somehow because it's his wife, something's going on where she's trying to, like, get the estate from him or who knows what. She's banging the mailman. I don't know. Whatever it is.
Yeah.
And
well, the mailman is pretty hot.
It's something that would be specific
and
to a problem that would occur in a marriage, not in a father-daughter relationship.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, a month into this, everybody's, you know, got all the sides. And all of a sudden it comes in front of you and you're like, none of this would even happen. It's my daughter.
Yeah.
If she's banging the mailman, that's gross, but it's not like...
Or like she's banging Pat's character. And Pat is like, and this is all in the down low, right? And Pat's character's acting really weird and guilty around me and stuff. And he's like, nah. But
Pat's fine with it.
Yeah. And the thing is that we have a lot of great role play about it. But then, like you said, it's revealed that it's like, well, wait a minute. No, that's not my wife. It's not your wife. Yeah, it's my daughter. So should I get a shotgun? Congratulations. My daughter's a hoe. You know,
she really is.
Yeah, wow. If I die, she can't get the estate from me because I've got a wife apart from the daughter.
Yeah, you know.
I have two wives now? What? How does this work? I mean, and so it can become a much bigger thing. I mean, we make that joke fairly often about that game that you were running where the gnolls were carrying torches. Well, gnolls have dark vision.
Yeah.
They wouldn't carry.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, well, that's how you're seeing them afar. Okay, fine. They're carrying, not a big deal. They're carrying torches.
Right.
Whatever.
Yeah. It is such.
It doesn't matter.
I think that you have to look, because that's a perfect example, too, where you reminded me that gnolls have dark vision. They wouldn't need it. And it's just like, I'm trying to paint a scene.
Yeah, and the gnoll's approaching. It's just like, okay, fine. Yeah. So I retconned it for you on the spot. I'm like, Gnarls instructed them not to terrorize humans.
Right.
So they're carrying torches simply so they're visible.
So they know,
Yeah, so they don't scare anybody by jumping out of the bushes.
When it's a minor, quick point like that, I say go with the retcon. I mean, just hand wave it, go with the retcon, because in a role-playing game, when you're playing and doing role-playing scenes or you're game master running it, momentum is everything. You don't want to sit there and go, well, maybe it's this kind of gnoll. Well, hand me Monster Manual 3.
It's a water gnoll.
It's a water gnoll. Why don't have that? And it's like, don't be that guy. Just keep roll with it. Keep it going. Momentum is so very important. But what do you do on the longer one? Like we said, it's we're 6 months into a 2 year thing. Pat has altered his character to a significant degree. We've done this great role playing that neither of us want to get rid of, but the entire crux of it is a mistaken piece of information that is significant.
Yeah, and the problem
from a GM or from a player standpoint? From a GM standpoint, the easy answer is, hold on, I have to poop.
I'm with Wayne. Because especially depending on how far off course you have gone, that you were planning this and now this is not possible, or maybe you gave them the wrong information. You said that a crime happened on this spaceship when in fact it happened on that spaceship. Yeah. And I have painted myself into corners before with flubs like that. There's no moving forward with this.
Right.
If I move forward, and I did try moving forward a few times, I'm just trying to improv mistake upon mistake upon mistake. Mm-hmm. And my foundational document, that what's really going on document, yeah, has now just gotten thrown out the window. So I don't even have a sense of how this world works anymore.
Right.
And, you know, I can wing it for a bit, mm-hmm, but I have to fix this pretty quickly.
I think you hit on something there, too. For the long run, for the big problems that we're talking about, you got to be careful of, like you said, well, I wing it and just keep going with it. We want to keep the momentum
going.
You make
it worse.
Yeah, you're adding a problem on top of a problem. And because what you have to do is you have this tangled knot. The goal is to untangle it without cutting the rope.
Mm-hmm.
And by just keeping on messing with it, you're just making the knot worse.
Yeah, I think in a situation like this one, an extreme, and I will call this the extreme.
Yeah, this is pretty rare,
hopefully is not going to happen very often. And if it does, it should be very rare. Mm-hmm. I think in an extreme case like this, you have to stop.
Yeah.
Everyone involved, you have to talk about it. And that's probably going to be the entire group.
Yeah.
I think you have to talk about it because you have to work. Everyone has to work together, but it falls largely on the GM as mm-hmm. the spearhead of it, because I think you're going to need to go back and retcon some things, rewind the clock, and figure out, okay, a mistake was made. We need to fix it because we need to right the ship. We need to talk about, yes, we've had a lot of role play that's gone on here, but at this point, we need to fix it. So we're going to have to modify a little of everything. Yeah. We're going to have to modify some of the role playing that all the characters have done. I'm going to have to modify, as the GM, mm-hmm. I'm going to have to modify some of the plot hooks and the plot directions that I've gone. We're going to have to fix it. I think, you know, take the session to fix it, right the ship, and then try to get back on course.
I think the most important thing is, like you said, stop. Everybody stop. Okay, we're not playing now. Let's get everybody on the same page. You know, it's the daughter, not the wife. Is everyone cool with that?
And
how does this affect your character? Because I can look at Wayne, and Wayne's like, hell, I wasn't f***ing her. I don't care. This is a major thing.
Yeah, some characters are going to be, not going to be anything other than, like, I was round, but it doesn't affect me at all.
And I can think of a lot of things as a GM you can do at that point if you stop and don't make it worse.
Yes.
Yeah.
Things like, she said she's the wife, but she's really the daughter.
Yeah, I mean, Beth could have taken it on to, well, yeah, this is the NPC, and this is why I'm playing her. She's deceived you as the player. She, to make you think that is, for some reason, she's playing off his wife instead of his daughter. What the fuck is she doing?
I think it's also important, like, let's say the Beth and myself issue with the daughter and the wife. It is vitally important to do what is best for the overall game and not say, no, it has to be my daughter. That is how I wrote it. It has to be like this and take it to the map.
So,
I mean, there is, you do want a certain level of everybody is happy.
I think that's part is figure out what's best for the situation.
Absolutely.
It's not something I can just give you a clear-cut answer to
as
a general rule. I mean, it's really going to be specific to the situation. Sometimes
malleable.
Yeah, and everyone, the game master, the players all need to be malleable because it may be any one of you that has to give on this. But what I'm thinking of the major flubs I've done as a GM, I've always done, at least in the games that worked out, exactly what you described, Chad. I stop the game, say, wait a minute.
Yeah.
I got that wrong. They were not on ship A. They were on ship B. And typically, this causes a moment of confusion. Who is on ship? This guy. And I will
stop and make sure everyone's on the same page.
It takes 30 minutes to sort this out to make sure everyone has their brain right.
Yeah.
And then at that point, especially if it's a game master, good God, don't hold people too responsible for things. I mean, except there's, look, this may mean some scenes that happen now have variable levels of truth to them anymore. Yeah. Even though someone said something 5 minutes ago, they only said it because they thought something else was true. Let them off the hook on that. Let them move their characters around. If you have to change something up, change up the current moment and just pretend part of what happened leading up to this didn't happen.
Sometimes
to get back on the correct course.
Hand waving is okay.
Yeah.
You're not making a multi-million-dollar movie. You're not writing the next great American novel. Yeah. So if someone were chronicling your game, the hand wave is one of those times when you're reading a book and you're like, did a page get ripped out? What just happened here? But because a role-playing game is always going forward and it always has momentum, it's okay to occasionally hand-wave.
Yeah, I think if it's really minor.
Yeah.
If it's a really minor thing, you hand-wave it. You don't even give it a second thought. Just go with
like
the flow,
with
hand-wave it, and get over it. There's no need to stop, no need to break momentum.
With our Monster Hearts campaign, where it's
we
didn't have that conversation.
Yeah.
Almost anything that happens in the same session, I think, can just be hand-wave.
Because I think the situation we just described is a major thing. That's where I think you should fix it, but it has to get to that point. If you're not dealing with major shit like that, then I think you don't have any business worrying about this kind of crap. Well, just hand wave and go on. Be like you said, be flexible and, you know, put on your big boy pants.
Being a comic book guy, I mean, retcons are something that happen in comic books all the time where something has happened different. Typically, the way they approach it is they don't go back and retell each individual story. You know, something different happened, and somehow you still ended up in the same place.
Well, I think
you don't need to redo every conversation.
Yeah, and I think that's fine.
Absolutely.
Put that way. One thing I'd be careful about, I was reading the plot synopses of the full Space Odyssey series, that quadrology, which I think is what you call a series of four books. And I was reading the plot because I picked that book series up and started reading it, but I only read 2061 and 3001. And I read them with a pretty good gap between them.
Yeah.
And then I read both of those a long time ago. So my memory of them is real spotty. And the movies for 2001 and 2010 don't really mesh that well because they were done in wildly different styles.
Yeah.
So out of curiosity, I went back and read the plotline to 2001, 2010, 2061, 3001. And they don't line up all over the place. For example, in 2001, the signal from the monolith was sending them to Saturn. Hmm. But in 2010, they're at one of the moons of Jupiter, whereas in 2001, it was one of the moons of Saturn.
Mm-hmm.
Then by the time you get to 2061 and 3001, Arthur C. Clarke has pushed the events forward because, of course, those years are getting closer and those events aren't happening. So now all of a sudden the events of 2001 actually happened in like 2030, and the events of 2010 happened in 2040 or 2050. He pushes them all forward. Hmm. And the way he explained this now, okay, I'm not this gullible. I know what the truth is here. The way he explained it was he was describing four like quantum string type universes, which is physicist bullshit.
Yeah.
He was retconning.
Yes.
But the point is that can still work because I can still read it with a cognitive dissonance that 2001, in fact, happened in 2031 because of the fact that there's only one storyteller. Where this gets complicated in a role-playing game is there's not one storyteller. There are many storytellers. You have the GM, who is, of course, the largest contributor to the story. But then you have the players who are also contributors to the story. And so if you start just saying, well, yeah, all that stuff you said about your character, in fact, isn't true anymore in comic book style, one, they may not be cool with it. And two, even if they're cool with it, you got to be sure they've got that straight in their head that I'm going to change or add or whatever all these things about your character. And even if you're cool with it, you still got to know it and know how to run with that and make sure that everyone's on the same page about what's happened up to this point.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Since we're still on the topic of this Monster Hearts game, or at least that's what inspired us, we're going to continue with our Monster Hearts themed episode.
Dan, have you ever played Monster Hearts?
No, I have not. I'm
going to roll familiar? This turn on with my cold. Use my sex move on him.
Are you familiar with Monster Hearts?
I've defeated that Pat's only, evil spirit with my shell silver
that
stain.
Only fuels me on even more.
No, if it didn't get Brodor, I don't believe it's going to get you.
Oh, it would.
Monster Hearts does something that a lot of the newer indie games are doing that I find kind of interesting. We've always talked about, you know, avoiding the meta information, and Monster Hearts embraces it. And a lot of these other games are doing kind of the same thing. Even Fate does it to a degree. Where with Monster Hearts, when you start your session, you highlight the skills that you as a person want to see the other person play their character as. So, for example, at the beginning of the game, let's say
Let me interrupt you real quick. Let's just lay a definition of what the meta is for anyone who's not familiar with the term.
Sure.
Meta comes from a Greek word, which we somewhat misuse. But the concept of the meta game is that there's a game outside of the game. For example, my character may have certain predispositions and certain stats and such. And let's say Chad's character does something to kind of annoy me. Well, in character, I do something crazy, but I know it's going to wreck the game. So I make the metagame decision that between Dan and Chad, this is a bad idea. So our characters aren't going to do that.
Right.
It can also get done at the game master level of saying, well, I don't think the game master would kill me, so I'm going to do this. Or with Fate, I have this skill, but I know I have these fate chips that I need to kick off my abilities, and I want to save some for later. So even though my character has no reason not to act according to the fullest of their abilities, I'm not going to. So this is the metagame, the game that's outside of the game.
Well, and from a GM perspective, it can also be things like, I know that had as a father, so if I throw a child in the game, I'll be able to get his attention.
Possibly in a bad way, but yes. Okay, so the meta thing is when people make their characters, obviously they have an interpretation of the characters. What I'm hearing that I can have an interpretation of their character.
Yeah, so one of the things Monster Hearts does that I find interesting is, and some of the other games that are based on Apocalypse World do similar things as well, but let's say at the beginning of the game, we've played 6-7 sessions, and I've seen how Pat's been playing, and I think, you know, I'd like to see Pat go in a different direction. Well, it comes up, I get to highlight his stats, and I say, I want to see you be violent this game. This is me as a person, as a player, I want to see Pat play his character a little more violently, so I'm going to give him a mechanical incentive in the game to do so.
Now, not you have to do this. It is literally an incentive in Monster Hearts.
If you do this, you will get an experience. XP for it.
Yeah, you'll get XP for it.
So then throughout the game, as you're playing, you're thinking, okay, I have these two skills that are highlighted. I haven't rolled this. I'd like to get XP. And then you start kind of thinking that way and take your character in directions you wouldn't have otherwise. And I find that fascinating because we've always been anti-meta. You know, staying in what would the character do? The games like this are really embracing it. And I know a lot of indie games are doing things like this. This is kind of something different for me. I'm not used to embracing other players' input on my characters and stat input on what I'm doing quite like I am in this game.
Well, I think one of the things that it helps with that we've seen be a problem in a lot of games. I mean, going back, it strikes me that the vast majority of problems I have seen within games in my life could have been solved by the group template. If I was to pick a second biggest source of problems in games, I would go with expectation. The game master expects to run one kind of game, but the players are in a different mood. One player expects something different out of the setting than the others. The plot goes in a direction nobody was okay with, or everybody, I don't, whatever. But it's about lining up expectations. But I think one of the great things this allows you to do is we've talked about players giving the GM feedback. And we've talked about giving social feedback from the GM to the players if there's an out-of-character problem. But one thing we really haven't talked about is the other table-level interactions. Of, I as a game master want to see something out of your character. Well, we've typically talked about achieving that through plot points or NPCs. But now we're talking about accomplishing at the meta, that I can say, I'm going to give you an incentive to play the charismatic side of your character, even though this is not necessarily what you are going to do this session. And here's, you don't have to do it, but here's an incentive to do it. And similarly, the players can have the same thing. They can say, you know, there's this angle of your character that I like, but really hasn't been explored. Or if you use it, would help draw me into the action. And so now I can use your character as a positive asset towards creating what for me is a better game in terms of fitting my expectations. But because everyone has this ability, it's not like one person suddenly running the train. It's, you know, everybody's got play in this.
Yeah, and I like the idea behind it because in the end, everyone's trying to have fun and tell the best story. And that kind of gives you feedback on what people are wanting to see. You know, as an example, let's say Chad is being the outgoing, boisterous, controlling the entire game character, which is the exact opposite of the character he's actually playing in this game, by the way. Mm-hmm. He's playing a very quiet character. But let's say he's playing that character. You know, I could give incentives for him to be
to
a more quiet
up.
Character. Yeah. And it's a nice way. It's a nice way.
It's a very nice way of saying shut up.
Yeah, it's a nice way to give the incentive for you to tone it down a little without coming out and saying, you know, you're being an 11 and I need you at a 7. Which, and I use that as an example this time because you're not doing that at all.
Right.
You are playing a very different type of character than you usually do.
I'm playing a 100-year-old dead homosexual med student who was violently and horribly murdered, but he doesn't know how or
if
who
I was in this
and
game,
doesn't know where his body is.
I would offer you tons of meta XP points if at some point you invent blueberry cereal.
Hey.
I'm just saying. He's a med student. The knowledge of, I mean, especially comes from, you know, that kind of time when people are still playing around with medicine and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So maybe kind of has the same school thought as Kellogg.
Yeah.
And
he's a ghost. Yeah, so there's a theme there.
Right. And so he decides to come out with his own eponymous line of cereal. He makes blueberries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm just putting it out there. All right.
Yeah.
You run with that.
True. Mm-hmm. I think my favorite part of the game was Pat had to run upstairs to deal with some stuff. And he missed the entire part where everybody realized I had said that my character was gay, and he's playing a female witch seductress.
He's trying to seduce
me. And I'm like,
yes, that's right.
And I'm like,
you have that thing down there.
And then he's like, I don't know. Why is Chad playing like this? My character's really hot. I don't get it. And then my character starts hitting on Dawn's character because Dawn is playing a male character. And then suddenly Pat is just like, huh. Oh! Well, that explains everything.
It was great. Ivan used a nice 50s colloquialism that was great.
So obviously Monster Hearts has a specific mechanism by which they encourage this.
It's called the sex move.
No,
that's
a
different
four stats.
60% of the time works every time.
That's right.
But that's something you can still use in every game, even if there's not a mechanic for it that encourages it. I think the mechanic still draws out a useful concept.
One of my favorite things to see happen in a game are games that have bennies, where the players are rewarding each other with bennies.
And if the bennies are M&Ms.
No, then they just get eaten.
Yum yums.
Yeah, I like the bennies or the fate chips, because that's really what I think that's what they amount to as well is to encourage that kind of incentivization.
You know what I like
something.
Is when it comes to like the fate chip sort of thing was something that I've only ever seen it in the Chris Mays
Blaxploitation game.
Yeah, Black Men Take Atlantis, what did he call it?
Fear of a Black Man's Atlantis.
Fear of a Black Man's
Atlantis.
Which is
based on the Public Enemy album, Fear of a Black Man's Planet.
Gotcha. Yeah, Fear of a Black Man's Atlantis. And I think it was like Savage Worlds or something. And
yeah,
so he was passing out the whatever the Savage Worlds calls them, the bennies or whatever.
Bennies.
And people were role-playing so well and saying such clever crap and doing such awesome stuff. Chris couldn't keep up with giving out the bennies. And so players were taking their limited supply of bennies, which they have only earned, and giving them to other characters, other players, saying, that was awesome, have this. And I like a game where it makes an economy of that. Like, there's a limited number, and the players pass it back and forth. I've actually tried to make a game where that leans on that as a mechanic. I've never quite got the mix right for it, though.
Yeah, I think this is one we may come back and develop more later date, but at least as an early thought.
How do players reward other players?
Well, just even, I guess, at the broader level is we certainly embrace the metagame in certain aspects, but it doesn't have to be limited to those aspects. You know, it's okay to interact with the metagame.
Yeah.
I mean, and what we typically rail against is when the metagame intrudes in an unwanted way upon the game.
Right.
Metagame knowledge. You know, people saying things their characters wouldn't know or acting wildly out of character. But in this case, we're not talking about...
I know that annoys the crap out of Pat, is the characters acting on the player's metagame knowledge.
But in this case, we're not talking about character actions. We're talking about player actions on other players.
Right, yeah.
And that's something that I think a game can benefit from or only benefit from, generally speaking.
I think it's a good way... Because I remember years ago, we've probably had a couple episodes on players who get into ruts, they get into certain role-playing ruts. And this is a great way of embracing this meta to try to subtly get them to play out of the rut.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you're always playing this guy and you're always using this ability and you're always having this one catchphrase.
Positive reinforcement to do something else.
Yeah.
Yep. As opposed to negative reinforcement to stop the habit.
Instead of saying, listen, jackass, stop playing the whatever, play something else. Well, why don't you let him play what he wants and then try to influence him to play how you want him to play. I mean, essentially, that's what you're saying, is how you want him to play. Because you always know best.
Yeah, whether you know best or not, I think you've got a fair vote at the table.
Yeah.
All right, so as always, check the show notes. Link out there to the American Heart Association fundraiser that we were doing.
And when Fear the Boot wins at charity, we all win at charity.
That's right.
That's right.
So,
But we win.
But we win, and that's really important.
Ultimately, we win. There's a huge black tie event that goes on forever wins this charity thing that we get to go to in Grand Cayman.
Well, right, yeah, yeah.
I think we've all been affected by heart disease. Everyone around the table has somebody in their life that has. Mm-hmm. So we win in that way, too. But the important part is we win.
We win.
I actually have not. But nonetheless, I still recognize the importance it has upon society. So anyways, thank you guys for tuning in. Have a great week and great games. And we will catch you next time.
See ya.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2014. Listeners are free to use this show in any non-commercial endeavor as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com. Fear the Boot is also a member of the Pulp Gamer Media Network of shows. You can find other great shows in this network at pulpgamer.com.